Morning, it's Monday, April the 25th, 2005. It's now about 8:40 a.m. Senator French is with us, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins, and Senator Terrio and Senator Guest will be with us before long. We're going to start out this morning on a revisor's bill, and we have Mr. Crawford here, the assistant revisor. Mr. Crawford, welcome to the Judiciary Committee this morning. If you'll put yourself on the record, we're ready to go to work this morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is James Crawford. I'm one of the assistant revisors from Ledge Legal here presenting the 2005 revisor's bill, which is a bill that gets generated every year under the authority of 0105036, which basically commands the revisor to go forth and fix things in the statutes.
Okay, I just want for the record to indicate that Senator Terrio is with us. Go ahead, sir.
The fixes, which are nonpartisan and policy neutral, fall into three general categories. Fixes that improve the form or substance of the statutes, and an example of that might be to correct grammatical errors or to conform language to the drafting manual style. And those are the most common amendments that you will find in the bill this year. The second category of problems and their solutions are those that update obsolete provisions. And just for example, a provision may become obsolete either through the passage of time or through a repeal where we didn't catch all of the cross references and we need to go through and clean up that sort of thing. That's the second most common category of amendment you'll find in the bill this year. And the third category of problems that we address are those that correct errors and oversights. And generally what's involved in this third category is a situation where the language that the legislature has chose to implement its intent in a particular section for some reason doesn't match up with that intent. There's a disconnect between what they were trying to do and the language that they chose to do that with. And that is this year the least common amendment that you'll find in the bill. A little bit about the process of the bill. What happens is one of the revisors will generate this bill, and then the other two revisors in the office will take a look at it to make sure that everything in the revisor's bill is something that should be there. And the filter that they use on that is to make sure that it doesn't make a substantive policy change. In other words, what we're trying to do is to correct errors of form or to match up the language in a given section to a policy decision that's already been made. After we finish our review of the draft revisor's bill, we send it over to the Department of Law, to the regulations attorney, Ms. Debbie Baer, and she sort of parcels it out amongst the various attorneys in the Department of Law that work in the different areas of law, and they all take a look at it to make sure that everything's copacetic too. And so what we have are a number of different eyes looking at the bill to make sure that it does what it's supposed to do and doesn't do what it's not supposed to do. But sometimes even that number of eyes isn't enough. And it's come to our attention that we actually make a change in the revisor's bill that we probably shouldn't be doing. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time on that this morning. So I direct the committee's attention to page 96, bill section 94, which is the repealer.
Page 46, section 94?
Correct. You will see that we are repealing two sections. We're repealing a number of sections. Two of the sections are 4466020 and 4466030. These two sections were enacted, I believe, in 1977, and they relate to the concept called program budgeting. That was a concept of budgeting or paying for state government that made the allocations and appropriation by program. And one of the attorneys in our office who deals with appropriations brought this to my attention. That was used for a couple of sessions following 1977. And then we went to a different method of budgeting. Instead of budgeting by program, by and large, we budget by the governmental subunit that administers the program, which is to say we fashion our appropriations bills in general by appropriations to the departments or to the agencies that administer programs rather than to the programs themselves. And in his research, he discovered that these sections really, for the most part, stopped being used around 1979, 1980. And we've gone to a different method of budgeting. So he proposed it for inclusion in the revisor's bill based on the fact that it seemed to have become obsolete. But the legislative auditor, Ms. Pat Davidson, brought to our attention that there is a portion, that at a minimum, there is a portion of one sentence of one of the two sections that we're proposing for repeal that has continuing potential applicability. That is the second half of the first sentence of subsection B of 4466020 remains relevant for ongoing operations of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. That being the case, we should not be repealing it in a revisor's bill. The thing is, that particular sentence fragment is so intertwined with the rest of the sentence and the rest of that section, and that section is so intertwined with the next section, 030, that in order to preserve that piece of the section, we really have to pull the entire section out of the repeal along with the next section. And so what we are recommending is that 4466020 and 4466030 be pulled out of the repealer. And there are a couple, three sections in the bill that made conforming amendments based on their repeal. They have to come out too. And I prepared an amendment for the chair of Ledge Budget and Audit Committee, Senator Terrio, for the committee's consideration that does exactly that.
That's 020 and 030?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio.
I'll offer the amendment language now as amendment number one.
Senator Terrio has offered amendment number one. I'll object for explanation and discussion.
Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Crawford has indicated, the legislative auditor has requested that those sections, although they're somewhat unused, that she sees some benefit to retaining them in statutes, and the revisor's bill really should contain only those things that everybody agrees should be pulled as cleanup, pure cleanup. So if there's any desire to keep it in, it should be left in the statutes.
And Senator, Ms. French?
Just a question about the material on page 21, lines 1 through 31. The effect of, I can understand the description of why we're not repealing 4460020 and 4466030. But it's not clear to me how that relates to the material on page 21.
Through the chair, the reason why we were amending this particular section, which is 242271, is because we were pulling out 4466020 and 030. And if you will look at the language that was proposed for deletion, you will see reference to those particular statutes. Now, there is, in fact, other language throughout that section that was also proposed for deletion that does not reference those two sections. But those deletions within this, within Bill Section 41, were caused by their repeal or their proposed repeal. And so that is the relationship between the two sections that were formally proposed for repeal and the changes that were being made here.
Thank you. Senator Terrio, as LBNA chair, have you had a chance to review the material?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm based on Mr. Crawford's suggestion and conversation with the auditor, I feel that basically we're just retaining the status quo in the statutes. So.
Is there a further objection to the amendment? I've removed mine. Amendment number one is adopted. Go ahead, sir.
One more thing. I just wanted to let the committee know that as a consequence of this, in addition in the future to sending the draft revisers bill to the Department of Law, we're also going to start sending it to Ledge Finance and to Ledge Audit so that they'll have a chance to look at it up front. With that, I'll stand by to answer any questions any of the members of the committee have for any of the rest of the bill.
Any other questions? Hearing none. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on this bill? No one online? No one in the audience? Public testimony is closed. Wishes of the committee. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask move that the Senate Judiciary CS for Senate Bill 101 be moved from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
There's one fiscal note for zero. Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill's moved on. Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Slight recess. Bill before us this morning is House Bill 54. Sponsor is Representative Ralph Samuels. Representative Samuels is with us this morning. Good morning, Mr. Samuels. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing this bill in a timely fashion. I certainly appreciate that. HB 54 does several things. There are four basic parts to it. Part one, right now defendants may be granted bail every 24 hours, and victims of crime have a constitutional right to attend every proceeding that the defendants have a right to be at. So what the bill proposes doing is stretching that time out to 48 hours. And the way that works in practical application right now is a defendant can ask for a bail hearing and ask for a bail hearing. The district attorney's office drops what they're doing, goes over and answers the bail review. There have been no changes in substantive facts. The victims, if it's a property crime or a crime against a person, usually have to leave their job to go to the hearing if they so choose to participate in all the proceedings, and it's a daily occurrence. And what we're trying to say in the bill, in part one of the bill, is that there is no new information. You can't just do this because you can. There must be some change, and you have to give the 48 hours notice. It's been in the Department of Law. I'm sure it's going to testify in a little bit after, but it's way that was explained to me is that an original bail is set, and it's usually set at a pretty high level to let either the alcohol or the emotion, everything kind of clear out of the situation. It goes to the judge the first time. We're not changing that. The first judge then sets the bail, and after that we're requiring the 48 hours notice. So you get the first shot at it. It goes down to what would be the more reasonable for that particular crime, and then if nothing changes, then you have to give a 48-hour notice for the victim to be notified and the district attorney to be notified. The second part of the bill, it would make it clear that the victim may be introduced to the jury during the opening statements or during the jury selection process. And currently some judges allow this and some judges do not allow this. Defendants are routinely introduced, and what that part of the bill would do would just making sure that the victim of the crime, if there is something, whether it be a property crime or a person crime, that you put a face on it. This person had their window shot out in a series of vandalisms down a suburb street, or this person is a real person and their child was killed. So making sure that it's equal on both sides there. The third part of the bill, it cleans up some language in the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and we're going to allow a retired attorney or physician to serve on the board. Right now they have trouble getting practicing physicians and attorneys to take the time on this board, and the thinking behind that, and we are approached by the board itself, is that if you want this skill set that a person has, an individual has, that you don't need to be a practicing physician to have the same knowledge base to serve on the board, and it would kind of open up the pool of people who would be willing to serve their community on that board. The fourth part of that is probably the most controversial part. And it would give the victim a right to appeal a sentence that falls below the range that this legislature set in the Blakely case. And we switched from one number to a range of numbers. And what this part of the bill would say was that if the total aggravators and mitigators added up, if the total sentence then goes below the low end of the range, that the victim could file a petition for review to the appellate court to review that sentence. And there will be testimony following me that will tell you that the practical implications of that are difficult. Who's going to answer the petition? Because jeopardy attaches, so the sentence cannot go back up. So the defense lawyer has absolutely no incentive whatsoever to answer it. It's just spinning their wheels to them. The district attorney and the public defender have probably agreed on the sentence of the district attorney. Nobody has any incentive to go and answer this. But my answer to all of those things are the convicted criminals have the right to appeal their sentences, and that the victims, and whether we take in this one very small step at a time, should also have to. And I don't see Mr. Wolliver here, and I don't know if he's online. He will also tell you that the court system does not like this. And my answer to both the Department of Law and to the court system is that we can't not follow the policies. If we think that the victims of crime should have a right to either have a bigger voice in the sentencing process or the right to appeal, we shouldn't let the bureaucracies dictate what our policies are. The broad policy decision should be set by us, and if it's a hassle, then they'll have to work it out. And I realize that, you know, there's a fine line there between some of these practical applications and some of the statements I just made, but and we do that, and I fully respect what Dean and Susan are about to come up here and tell you also, or if Doug Wolliver is going to come on board. We had discussions in the House on, instead of a petition for review, is a flat-out right to appeal. And if the committee chooses not to adopt this language in the bill, then I will continue to see how else can the victim have more impact in the sentencing structure then. It's my belief right now you can give a statement at sentencing, and it's my belief by then the deal's already done. The judge knows what the sentence is going to be, and it might make the victim feel better, but you don't really have an impact. That's my personal belief, that usually the public defender or the defense bar and the Department of Law have already made a deal on a sentencing range. The judge is going to go along with it, and the victim is pretty much left voiceless. So this was one way we thought to address that. I understand the controversy of it. I certainly do. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, or I know that there's a couple of folks behind me that have some opinions, particularly on that last section as well.
Questions for the sponsor? Senator French.
A quick one. Representative Samuels, thank you for bringing us this good bill this morning. Appreciate it. The bail review material, your sponsor statement says that it applies to if a person is charged with an unclassified crime or a Class A felony, you can make application to the court to review bail conditions. But your bill applies across the board. Your
yes.
bill applies to all bail reviews. And the idea is that after the magistrate sets bail and after arraignment in district court, it's after that that this your bill kicks in.
Yes, sir.
And that there'd be 48 hours before any subsequent bail review beyond that district court arraignment.
Through the chair, that is my understanding of my bill, yes. Unless there has been a change in some conditions. Something
right.
substantive has changed,
right.
then you can go back in and get the bail released.
So I'm just kind of thinking out loud. Typically, it takes, a public defender doesn't get appointed until the district court arraignment. They don't get appointed when the magistrate arraigns someone. The magistrate just sets bail, puts them in jail, and then the defendant appears in front of a district court judge. District court judge appoints a public defender. So chances are this person doesn't have a lawyer even through that district court bail setting. I just want to make sure we're all together. So by the time the lawyer gets involved, lawyer gets their hands around the facts, hands around the person's financial statement, their hands around their who might be a third-party custodian, at that point it's going to be 48 hours before you can have a bail review. And the idea is to make certain that the victim has notice and that something has changed.
Through the chair, that's correct. That the victim can get the notice and that it's not judge shopping. You know, you go through the bail hearing until you find a judge who's more friendly and on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And you know more about the day-to-day process, and I would probably defer to my attorneys in the back. To
Brad, I may just explore that a little bit more with the folks behind you. I just want to make sure I understood kind of the basic idea.
Yes.
I agree with the basic idea. The basic idea is that they put these bail hearings on day after day after day, and it's just harassment at some point. Thank you. That's all I have for now.
Senator Huggins, and for the record, Senator Guest has joined us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Samuel, when you look at the your provision for introduction of the victim, is there a provision for the family? Does that include the family, or?
Through the chair, victim is defined in statute. And do you have a copy of the definition of victim? Victim is defined in there in statute. Crime against a person, it'd be the parent or the spouse. Usually the way it will work is somebody will be designated as the spokesman for a family, for instance. You know, so if even if it's a property crime and somebody got a pellet gun, they went and shot a bunch of windows out on a bunch of cars, certainly the intent of the bill is certainly not to allow a family of five to all come up and be introduced one at a time. It would be somebody to say, this is Mr. Jones, and his family's car was shot out. So
a victim can be a collective term?
Yes.
I think your able help is bringing you that statute.
Very good. The brains of the outfit is coming to the rescue here. And through the chair again, victim in 1255-185 is a person against whom the offense has been perpetrated, an individual living in a spousal relationship with a person, a parent, adult, child, guardian, or custodian of the person, a person living in a spousal with the deceased, and on. So it's pretty clearly defined in statute. So the intent is not to introduce 100 people in the courtroom one at a time. That's certainly not the intent. But
and person could include a corporation in a situation like that as well.
Yeah.
A corporation that was harmed by the. We have a universal definition of person in Alaska statutes, as I understand it. It's an all-inclusive term.
And Mr. Chair,
individual is different. Go ahead, Senator Huggins.
And I'd just like to put an exclamation point after the piece where you said if you wait until sentencing time frame for the victim to get any recognition factor is a so what proposition. So I don't know how you picked up on that, but good for you.
I have questions, Senator Representative Samuels, and this is let's go back to the appeal section that you were talking about. While we don't weigh our decisions based on testimony on the other side, is there some kind of a rationalization or rationale behind the language that's there now? That is it simply because we are trying to find an accommodation with the preference of the courts and the Department of Law? What if you could review that for me again? Why did you
the original
depart
bill
from what I thought what I'm reading may have been your intent?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The original, we had a separate piece of legislation which would have given victims of crime standing throughout the process. And in talking with the Department of Law and the court system, if you have a victim of crime who has standing in, let's say, an evidence rule that comes in there, and me as a private citizen without an attorney, should I have standing on whether or not this evidence comes in or out when I know nothing about what the law says? So that became more and more and more problematic than what we actually put in the bill. We said from the get-go, if the victim is now the third party looking over the shoulder of the district attorney, making sure that they bless every decision that they make, and even to us very much pro-victim people, we understand the problems of going that far. So what we try to do is take a very small bite at the apple here, just on the sentencing, just for the petition for review. So we could have gone a whole lot further with the bill. I don't think the bill would have gone anywhere then, because the practical implications would have overwhelmed it.
No, I'm not. I'm not a lawyer, and but it appears to me, from a position of justice, that a petition of review paid for by a victim, which could have some other ramifications that, in terms of precedent, law, all other kind of ramifications that may not be attractive to me.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Grinnelli, not to put words in his mouth, but he has advised me to be careful what I wish for, that if you lose the appeal and you say that sentence is reasonable, now you've got case law backing it, and next thing you know, you've gone probably the wrong way that I would go. I'll let him testify for himself, but that and once again, I fully understand the problems with the section. We understand that. Once again, we didn't want the bureaucracies driving the bus, and we wanted to have the debate.
We're willing to allow him to have a seat on the bus, though.
fair enough.
All right. Well, other questions for the sponsor? If not, let's thank you, Representative Samuels, for presenting the bill to us this morning. And who's next? Mr. Grinnelli? Welcome, Mr. Grinnelli, to the hot seat this morning. And if you...
Thank you, Mr.
That you're properly attired again as you were on Saturday. Welcome back, and if you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your comments here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dean Grinnelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Attorney General's Office. I appreciate Representative Samuels representing my position ably on this bill. Let me just say that we support the vast majority of this bill, particularly the provision on the bail, limiting the number of bail reviews. there was one recent case in Anchorage where a defendant was able to schedule bail reviews 8 successive days in front of 8 different judges with the exact same proposal to get released, and it drives victims crazy. It drives our office crazy, just trying to keep victims notified of what the hearing is and what the schedule is. Let me just try to address Senator French's concern. There is an existing statute that says when you first come before a judicial officer, that starts a 48-hour clock running, if you will, and you haven't been released after 48 hours, you're entitled to a bail review. So you first come before a judge, 48 hours later you're entitled to bail review. As a practical matter, Senator French is correct that most defendants don't have attorneys right when they come before the judge the first time. It's usually 24 hours later when they get an attorney. So ordinarily 24 hours later they've gotten an attorney, or the attorney is public defender is there in court, can talk to them, and the public defender usually makes an application for bail at that point after 24 hours. And then the existing statute gives them an opportunity after 48 hours after their first appearance. What this bill does is it says you can't keep going 24 hours after that. We're at least taking 48 hour leaps after the first 48 hours. So I think that there is plenty of opportunity during the first 48 hours someone is in custody for them to see the judge very first time, see the judge when they've got an attorney, and see the judge after 48 hours. But then it's 48 hours each successive time, and I think that's a...
We're back on the record, and Mr. Grinnelli, if you'll go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to turn my attention now to the part of the bill that Representative Samuels described as the most controversial, and that is allowing a victim of the crime to file a petition for review to have an appellate court review a sentence that's below the sentencing range for the crime. I find it difficult to address this because I know that Representative Samuels has tried very hard to craft this in such a way that it will have minimal impact on the court system, on the Department of Law, yet try to achieve the the goal that he seeks, which is to give the victim an additional voice in the process. I think that let me try to explain my concerns. As Representative Samuels said, because of the double jeopardy provisions in the Constitution, a sentence that has been meaningfully imposed by a judge cannot be reduced upon appeal by the state. If the state appeals the sentence as being too lenient, the only thing that can happen is the court can say, yes, we agree it's too lenient, we don't think judges ought to impose sentences like this in the future, and you know, we have an opinion at least the court has disapproved a sentence like that. That very rarely happens. We've only had probably a handful of sentences disapproved by the appellate courts in over a period of many years. And so I think that the other thing that happens when the state appeals a sentence is too lenient, if that sentence is upheld by the courts, then it establishes a precedent saying that a sentence at this, you know, of this amount, sentence that state believes is too low, is okay, that's something that the courts approve of. We think very, very carefully before we appeal a sentence as being too lenient, because it does establish a precedent like that. It may very well be that only one judge in the state imposes a sentence at that low range. And yet, if we have a published court opinion saying that's okay, other judges may look at that opinion and, not wanting to be reversed themselves, they may adopt that lower sentencing pattern. So we think very carefully before we do that, and we analyze what effect an opinion of that sort would have on the criminal justice system in Alaska as a whole. We do that because that's our role in the system. Our role is to try to look at the administration of justice in Alaska as a whole. I think that the role of a victim of a crime is somewhat different. I think the victim of the crime does not necessarily have the interests of all of the criminal justice system of the state of Alaska foremost in their mind. And so if a victim takes a petition to have a court review a sentence, the most that they get out of it is they get an opinion saying that, you know, the court shouldn't have done that. The defendant doesn't get any more jail time. And what is risked, on the other hand, is a published court opinion saying that sentence was okay, that then may be adopted by other judges. Frankly, I think there's very little for the victim to gain, and there is something to be lost. And I expressed those views in House Finance Committee, so you know, I know that Representative Samuels is aware of them. I think there may be a broader philosophical concern about delegating prosecutorial authority of the state to a private person. Many years ago, in the early part of the century, actually in the last 18th century as well, criminal prosecutions were often done by private prosecutors, and that's something that most states got away from as years went on into the 20th century. I think there's a real policy question whether we want to have a private party take on some of the prosecutorial authority of the state and to challenge sentences. I'm not saying that this is necessarily unconstitutional to do it that way. I think the legislature has pretty broad authority to establish procedures like this. I just have some concerns about that. On the other hand, I do appreciate Representative Samuels narrowing it down to a petition for review. That's a discretionary petition for the court. The court can decide to accept that petition and decide that case or reject that petition. So I think that in the way he has done it, he's probably done it in the best and narrowest way that it can be done. I still have some overarching philosophical concerns about it.
So let me see if I understand this. Representative Samuels' concern is that in passing sentence, a judge has reduced the sentence below what the combined effect of the mandatory sentence plus any aggravators or mitigators may have prescribed. other words, the judge has rewritten state law.
I'm not certain that there's a sentencing range that the legislature has established. When the judge finds the existence of mitigating factors, the judge can go below that sentencing range. I think what this provision suggests is that when the judge does that, when the judge does go below the sentencing range, that allows a victim to come forward. I think we've got to assume that the judge has imposed a sentence in accordance with the law. It's just it's a low sentence from the victim's standpoint.
But the judge has the leeway within the law to find mitigators. Representative Samuels? Maybe you can help me here, Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the thoughts that went into this was that to go above the Blakely range, you had to go to a trial by jury. So to go up, you had this pretty big burden to jump over.
Right.
And during the Blakely debate, to go above the range,
they can stipulate.
Senator French.
That's what Blakely said.
Okay, go ahead, Representative
Samuels. To go below, we wanted to have another hurdle to go below. And during the Blakely debates, as we talked internally about it, we said, well, okay, you want a jury trial to go up? Well, we want a jury trial to go down. And we chose not to go. That was also problematic. So that's one of the reasons that we've now come up with this, which is now just a different set of problems. So I wouldn't characterize it as the judge's rewriting state law, but he's got a lot of latitude on the mitigators. On the aggravators now, he's got to go to a jury trial.
I see what you're saying. So you're addressing here your concern about a single person assigning mitigators versus a jury or a stipulation, as Senator French correctly pointed out, the aggravators.
Yes, sir.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Samuels or Mr. Guinelli, I'll characterize it as shining a light on the judge. That's what we're looking at doing, right? What are our other alternatives? Because I agree with you 110% that, people where I live, for the most part, are tired of this. The accountability factor, we've got to figure out how we do that. So what are our alternatives for shining a light on the judge?
Mr. Guinelli.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, under our existing system, judges stand for retention election once every, I think, 4 years, and then after that it's every 6 years, and it's once in a very great while. Very few judges in the state have ever not been retained.
I think been one.
Maybe a couple, but not very many. Not very many, Mr. Chairman.
And none since about 1982 or 3 or 4, somewhere in there.
I think that's certainly correct.
Nor has the Judicial Council recommended against retention of a judge since that time.
So I think that that publicity, mere publicity about the sentence, is not going to be terribly effective to do that. I think that the process the legislature went through this year in looking at the Blakely bill and the sentencing ranges and trying to establish some appropriate ranges for judges to exercise their discretion, I think that was a good exercise, and I think that's the way really to do it. For example, the methamphetamine bill, where it says if you're making methamphetamine in an area where there are children, it bumps it up a range. In other words, it takes away a little bit of judicial discretion by establishing circumstances that limit that discretion. That's probably the best way to do it. Unfortunately, that's almost on a, not necessarily crime by crime, but certainly a circumstance by circumstance basis. So it's not an easy thing to do with our current system. So I mean, I sympathize with Representative Samuels and his goals. It's just I, have other concerns.
Mr. Guinelli, in this sentencing process, it's possible for a sentence to be passed without trial. Isn't that correct?
certainly, 95% or plus of the sentences are imposed without trial. There's been a plea and a negotiation as to charges. Prosecutors ordinarily do not get involved in setting the in agreeing to a precise sentence. They might say they might agree to a, you know, we'll agree that the sentence won't be above a certain level, or they might say we don't want the sentence to be below a certain level. But picking the specific sentences is something not often done.
In the process of negotiating for sentence range, do you discuss mitigators with the defendant's attorney?
We do. Those are discussed. Aggravating factors are discussed, and generally throughout that process, we're also keeping in contact with the victim. You know, making sure they understand the risks of going to trial. If there's some weakness in the evidence, that they understand, you know, what risks there are, and what benefits there are in terms of a negotiated plea. So that's done as well.
Senator French,
thank you. Just first question. I take it this provision would not apply to misdemeanor sentences because we're talking about sentencing range, and sentencing range implies felonies.
Representative Samuels.
And just so I can get my sentencing law, maybe a refresher from Mr. Guinelli, but right now, if the state feels offended by the sentence that's handed down, you can petition for review, and you basically say this sentence is clearly mistaken. Isn't that the standard?
Through the chair, that's correct. And actually, the state actually has a right to appeal a sentence, which means that it forces the Court of Appeals to actually issue an opinion, and the standard is whether the judge was clearly mistaken in imposing that sentence. And I don't see any reason why the court wouldn't apply a similar standard to under this bill. In other words, if a victim appeals or petitions a sentence as being too lenient, same standard would apply.
Go ahead, Senator French.
So I'm sure what can happen. Let's just say it's a C felony assault, maximum 5 years. Let's say the judge has imposed 6 months. And let's say the state appeals, the Court of Appeals agrees the sentence was clearly mistaken. What happens on resentencing? What's available to the Superior Court judge on resentencing? Can he impose 5 years?
Through the chair, the sentence is disapproved as too lenient. The opinion is written, it's often published, and that's it. There is no resentencing. The double jeopardy clause prohibits that person from getting an increased sentence.
So it's an exercise, it's an intellectual exercise.
It is a precedent-setting exercise that if we believe the sentence is way out of line and we want it made clear to judges all across the state that kind of sentence that's way out of line shouldn't be imposed, that's when the state appeals a sentence is too lenient.
Senator French?
It doesn't have to be in published opinion. Most opinions are issued through what are known as mojos, and they carry no precedential effect. Out of any 10 opinions issued, one is published and nine are mojos, or 8-2 probably at the most. So I guess it's just important for the folks here to know that there's lots and lots of courts of appeals opinions issued that are not precedential. And I guess even of the ones that are precedential, I would assert that, Mr. Guinelli's free to comment, but I would assert that sentences are very fact specific. You spend a lot of time in court arguing over how this set of facts applies to that set of facts and why this set of facts is more egregious than that set. But they're always very fact specific, and so I agree. There's some area of concern here, but I think there's always plenty of room for good Department of Law lawyers to argue that a certain set of facts can be distinguished.
Mr. Guinelli, what would you estimate the rough cost of a review by the appellate courts would be for a victim who wanted to bring that action?
Through the chair, I don't know what filing fee the court would impose. Probably none. It would be a matter of hiring an attorney, and unless they want to do it themselves, but it would be the cost of an attorney. And you know, generally to do a sentence appeal, they're not terribly complicated. It, as Senator French says, many of them are fact specific. I would estimate probably 20 or 30 hours of an attorney's time, perhaps a little more, at let's say $150 an hour or something like that. I mean, it's going to cost a little bit of money for a victim. I mean, they're going to have to think long and hard before they want to go that step, knowing that they really aren't going to get much out of it other than perhaps maybe the satisfaction of saying, of a higher court saying, that was too low of a sentence.
So you can shine a light on the judge, but it has no practical effect and it costs you a lot of money.
That that may be one way of characterizing it.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Samuels, the victims' rights group, what if they offered an opinion or thought process, Mr. Branch Flower and Company?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the Office of Victims' Rights could be the law firm, so there would be no direct cost to the victim. The Office of Victims' Rights is essentially a law firm for victims. That's an important
distinction.
So they would give them standing to file a petition for review also.
So the Office of Victims' Rights could represent the victim in the appeal?
Yes, sir.
Do they do that?
I'll let you answer there.
Mr. Chairman, there was a very unusual case that actually is up before the appellate courts right now, where a victim through the Office of Victims' Rights filed an unusual type of petition, and that was accepted by the courts, and the Office of Victims' Rights did that case. That was a case where the sentence was arguably illegal. In other words, there was a statute that was contravened, and that directly related to, at least could be characterized as, protection of the victim. So I think that was an unusual case, but the Office of Victims' Rights did handle that case.
Senator Huggins?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would offer on behalf of multiple people I've talked to in Mat-Su, this is worth that extra mile of effort, and the organization we have that has that function, and I'm highly supportive.
Other questions for either Representative Samuels or Mr. Guanelli? Seeing not at the moment, I'm going to carry this bill over so we can give it some thought and discussion among members of the committee. Thank you very much for being here this morning, Representative Samuels, and we'll take... Senator Huggins, we're going to take 5-minute recess. Call the meeting back to order. We're back on the record. Next bill before us is House Bill 219. Representative Hawker is the sponsor. Staff for Representative Hawker is here to present the bill. Welcome this morning to the Judiciary Committee. Appreciate your being here. If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your introduction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Representative Hawker does appreciate you hearing the bill and sends his regrets. He had a bill up in Ways and Means, and I think he got the short straw and had to go there. And we do have, this bill was brought to us by, for the record, my name is Julie Lucky, and I'm staff to Representative Hawker. This bill was brought to our attention by a constituent that we are fortunate to have to testify today in person, Tara Henry, who is a forensic nurse consultant. She will be able to explain any of the technical aspects of the bill. Basically, what we found out was that strangulation assaults involving strangulation were not being prosecuted as felonies. And this was due to a bar that we set up in our statutes that said in order to be prosecuted as a felony, an assault must have provable serious physical injury. Studies have shown that serious assaults involving strangulation that were almost fatal may not leave any marks on the outside of someone's neck that you could then photograph and present to a jury as serious physical injury. And therefore, the crimes were not being prosecuted as felonies because it was almost impossible or very difficult to pass that bar without calling in expert witnesses to explain that many of the injuries were internal. that's basically the impetus for the bill. I'll be happy to answer any questions, or, like I said, there are people who know a lot more about this than I do that can answer questions.
Question for the sponsor this morning. Thank you, Julie. Who do you have next? Who would like to testify? Tara? Tara, welcome to Judiciary Committee this morning. If you'll put your name on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony.
My name is Tara Henry, and I'm a forensic nurse in Anchorage. For the last 9 years, I have been doing medical forensic examinations on victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, and child abuse. For the last 6 years, I've been assisting the state medical examiner's office on the forensic examination of victims who were murdered during a sexual assault or domestic violence incident. So over the years, I've had the unfortunate opportunity of examining and consulting on hundreds of cases involving strangulation. Some of those victims survived the strangling, and some of them did not. Strangulation is a very serious, sometimes fatal physical force that is used by perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual assault to control the victims so that they can complete the assault act that they are trying to complete. When a person is being strangled, oxygen exchange is prevented from occurring in the brain, and without oxygen, the brain cannot survive. So a person who does not have oxygen can go unconscious within seconds and be dead within minutes. And as a medical provider in this field, I was shocked to find that these cases, strangulation, which is potentially a lethal physical force, was being treated as a simple misdemeanor in our state. So for the last 5 years, I've been training and educating medical providers, as well as police and prosecutors, on the dynamics of strangulation and the potential lethality of this physical assault. So these cases are currently, some of them are being prosecuted as felonies, but many of them are not. Because the way of our statutes are written, it is very difficult in order to be able to meet what the statutes need in order to prosecute them as a felony. So House Bill 219 will provide the appropriate language in our statutes that's required so that all strangulation cases can be prosecuted as felonies. If you would, for a moment, take your finger and find the notch in your neck with me. And just underneath your thigh, press in about, and you can feel what it feels like when a victim is beginning to get strangled. Now, if you imagine somebody's hand or their forearm or a ligature around your neck squeezing and you have no control, you cannot breathe, you feel pain, you begin to get dizzy, and you go unconscious, not knowing whether you're going to wake up. Strangulation, when the person is applying that pressure, they are literally controlling whether you live or die. And so if you pass House Bill 219, we'll be able to prosecute all strangulation cases as the life-threatening assault that it truly is. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Henry? Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Senator French, did you have a question?
I'll just say briefly that I've been a student of Ms. Henry on this subject. And in a case that we did together, the defendant had choked the victim badly. We were able to charge it as assault in the third degree, a C felony. Took that into the grand jury and presented that. And after the grand jury got done hearing the evidence, they requested and indicted the gentleman for attempted murder. So Ms. Henry can be quite persuasive. And the defense attorney agreed that it was a righteous charge, and they pled very swiftly to the C felony.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Henry. Appreciate your being here this morning with us. Representative Hawker, your bill has been ably presented. Is there anything that you would like to add to the discussion this morning? Welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Oh, thank you, Mr.
Pull that over for the clerk there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Seekins, I'm certain that, quite frankly, these two people that have presented this bill will do a job far more ably than I could. And but we sincerely, this is a, I'll be honest enough, when I ran for the legislature, it was my serious intent never to make a pilgrimage to a judiciary committee on a criminal bill. I'm an accountant, not a lawyer, but when Tara Henry brought this bill to me, it was such a compelling argument for a need that we chose to take this up, and we'd sincerely appreciate your support for it.
Thank you for bringing it to us. Mr. Guanelli, you're next on my list, sir. Welcome back to the Judiciary Committee, Mr. Guanelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Dean Guanelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I'd actually signed up just to answer questions, but let me just say that this is it's a very simple bill. When we were looking at it earlier in the session, trying to figure out the best drafting of it, there was consideration of looking at all the assault statutes and changing the elements, and I think this committee has had some experience in other bills with how difficult that is. The intent, as Ms. Henry indicated, was trying to take assaults that occur with some level of strangulation and making sure that they are that those are felonies. The easiest and simplest way to do that is by changing the definition of dangerous instrument. A physical injury that is caused by means of a dangerous instrument becomes a C felony. We did not want to deal with the definition of serious physical injury in the assault in first and second degree. There's still a requirement to prosecute somebody for those serious felonies that serious physical injury be imposed, and that's a high level of injury. However, as Ms. Hendry indicated, simply by strangling somebody, cutting off their airflow, you run the risk of killing them. The injuries that are often created in the throat area with the swelling, if you don't kill them immediately because of the swelling, they have problems later. They may die later, but ultimately, when it's time to present that evidence to a jury, the person has recovered. They look fine. The marks around the throat may not have been all that great, but the risk certainly was there. And this is the simplest, cleanest way to do that. That's why this way was chosen, simply to take misdemeanor level, make it a felony.
Guanelli, is there any risk that the court might consider that hands used only in this method are deadly weapons?
Mr. Chairman, there actually is case law in Alaska and elsewhere where hands and even feet have been found to be deadly weapons based on the way they are used. Stomping somebody.
Dangerous instrument or deadly weapon?
Sorry, deadly weapons. And it is conceivable that depending on how the hands are used, we may try to have them classified as, under the facts in that specific case, as a deadly weapon. And perhaps get a higher sentence, but I think, given that the definition here is dangerous instrument, I think that's what the courts are probably going to be most comfortable sticking with.
The courts would now say that hands are only a dangerous instrument when they're used to impede normal breathing, circulation, etc.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I think the record should be clear that there's no intent to reverse any of the existing case law that on a fact-specific basis, as used in a particular case, that hands can be either a dangerous instrument or in some cases even deadly weapons. What this is designed to do is for those so that there's no question that mere impeding breathing, cutting off circulation of the blood, that is enough to get hands classified as a dangerous instrument. If there's something more beyond that, existing Alaska case law would allow them to be characterized as something else.
So let me see if my circular thinking here is correct, in your opinion at least. A dangerous instrument is any deadly weapon or anything that under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. If hands and feet now are considered to be a deadly weapon, in the definition of deadly weapon, would the use of hands in beating someone, threatening someone, be considered to be a dangerous weapon, since they are a deadly weapon, a dangerous instrument, since they are classified as a deadly weapon?
Yes, hands and feet can be characterized as a dangerous instrument under subsection A, depending upon exactly how they're used, what the person's intent is. It usually requires a fair amount of beating, or in the case of feet, stomping or kicking. Certainly, depending on the size and weight of the shoes, that also is something that is taken into account in determining whether feet or boots, shoes can be deadly weapons. But I think the answer is yes.
So, you know, and it's to my way of thinking, then I don't think it's the intent. For the record, it's not the intent of this committee, and someone can tell me whether they disagree or not, that by including definition B under dangerous instrument, that we are saying that only when hands are used in this manner are they dangerous instruments, but that they can be dangerous instruments under other circumstances.
That was certainly our intent in suggesting this drafting method.
Senator French?
I totally agree with your analysis, Mr. Chairman. I think that's right. No one's trying to restrict it. I think we're just trying to add one more to expand it. I just want to make sure the record's clear. About deadly weapon or dangerous instrument, it's always been my understanding that we tried to make hands and feet into dangerous instruments, not deadly weapons. And the definition of deadly weapon means any firearm or anything designed for and capable of causing death or serious physical injury, including a knife, an axe, a club, metal knuckles, or an explosive. So I
haven't we even addressed that in another bill here? It seems to me that we've been talking about that in other legislation this year. Mr. Grinnelli?
Mr. Chairman, I there actually is old Alaska case law before the criminal code that Senator French is quoting from that talked about hands and feet being deadly weapons. He is correct. The current code defines deadly weapon as he indicated, and so what the courts would rule is that they would be dangerous instruments. But I was referring to old Alaska case law that goes back many, many years.
I have no problem understanding the effect that someone's hand can have, or feet can have, or elbows could have, or defining hands within, depending on how they're used, as either dangerous instruments or deadly weapons, because I think they can be both. But so I wanted to just make sure here that we're not affecting that definition. Senator Huggins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. The professional fighters' hands are considered... I thought that was a deadly weapon.
Through the chair, in some states they are considered deadly weapons. I think for civil purposes they probably would be considered deadly weapons under civil law. But for under the criminal laws, as Senator French indicated, there's a more limited definition of deadly weapon, and that relates to, you know, firearms and those, you know, clubs and knives and those kinds of things. So hands would be considered dangerous instruments under this. I mean, it's still
French, could you read that definition for us again?
Sure. And they kind of interlock, as you can see, but deadly weapon means a firearm or anything designed for and capable of causing death or serious physical injury, including a knife, axe, club, metal knuckles, etc. But if you look at dangerous instrument, you'll see that it includes any deadly weapon. So all deadly weapons are dangerous instruments. But it also means anything that, under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is causing is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. And you know, hands are a good example, or a garrote, or, you know, a cloth if you're stuffing it in someone's mouth or something like that. There's lots of ways you can kill someone with something that isn't a firearm or a knife or a club. And it just relates to the manner in which you use it. So I think that we're all getting to the same place. It's just that hands aren't designed for causing death.
Mr. Guarnelli, is there any reason that this statute would not read on lines 8, serious physical injury, and includes hands or other objects rather than or?
Mr. Chairman, the reason why we set it out as its own separate subsection was because of the experience we have had in trials, where if you try to go under the definition under A, even if you say including, you still have to prove, and the jury has to believe beyond a reasonable doubt, that the way in which it was used threatened or was capable of causing death or serious physical injury. And that is the difficulty in that is the victim is on the stand, you know, she looks perfectly fine, there no long-term lasting effects of the strangulation, the swelling has gone down, the bruising has gone down, and trying to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to 12 people that it was done in that way has proven to be difficult. I mean, that's why this provision, so we wanted to have it be something completely separate.
I understand. I'm just trying to figure out whether, for terms of construction, the word and versus the word or, what preference we might have there, if we're not accomplishing the same thing, but I'm not a construction expert. But is there any comment on that from the members? Senator French?
I think the or is a good way to go. It gives you an alternative if you could actually charge the jury in the alternative and let them pick which method they thought was accomplished or done.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Senator Seekins. For the record, Representative Mike Hawker, District 32, Anchorage.
Pull that mic around, Mike.
In response to your question, sir, on the construct of using the word or, I probably ought to have the right bill book in front of me. There, I'll claim a certain degree of expertise here, having worked my way through college, being the logic tutor for the undergraduates. And or, the word or, may be construed either inclusively or exclusively. It may be one or the other, but not both. And conversely, it can also be one or the other and both. And in this case, again, I think you were concerned that, you know, we may not be able to construe this. I'm a little bit worried about forcing the construction where and, the word and, is always. It must be both A and B together all the time to be true. And I'd be a little concerned about forcing that conjunctivity between these two clauses that sincerely are quite different.
I think what I'm trying to get is make sure that it's inclusive and not exclusive. And if we're doing that, I have no problem. But I want to make sure that we're not being exclusive. So, Senator,
and I think by your interpretation, I would agree that, as you've stated, there is the intent of this legislation.
Senator Huggins.
So I can be tutored. Would you say or again, and an inclusive and exclusive? I thought I had you the first time around. It sounded to me like second time around you said the opposite.
And logic has nothing to do with legislation, by the way, Representative Hawk.
Senator, through the chair, Senator Seekins, I could not agree with you more on that conclusion. The premises clearly lead to that conclusion. And through the chair, Senator Huggins, you know, in just thinking in terms of the word or, We use the word or in dialogue and in construct of logical arguments, which is really what the code is. It's creating a logical framework to be interpreted by other folks. When we say or, sometimes we want to say it may be A or B, and it must be exclusively one or the other. And sometimes we wish to say, well, it may be either one of the two or both. It could, you know, A or B, as long as you make sure that one of the two is true and you can reach your conclusion. But so here I think we are in the, as Senator Seekins, I think that is the valid construct of this argument.
Okay. Answer your question, Senator Huggins.
So or is universal, is what you said.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, that is the, yes, that is what is, and in yes, that is problematic with the word or in the English language.
Our intent here is to make sure that it's inclusive, and our intent is to make sure that other crimes committed with by hands are not excluded from the definition of dangerous weapon or dangerous instrument or deadly weapon.
Because we would concur completely.
Thank you. Other questions? Hearing none, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? No one online? No one in the audience? Public testimony is closed. Discussion among the members? Seeing none, is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 219 with individual comments be moved. And with attached physical note.
We have a number of them. They're all zero. So Senator Huggins has moved that this bill be passed from committee with individual recommendation and the attached zero fiscal notes. Is there objection? Seeing none, this bill is passed on to the next committee of referral. Short recess.
Thank you.
We now are moving on to House Bill number 116. Representative Meyer is the sponsor of the bill, and we have able staff here to present the bill. If you put yourself on the record, we're eager to go forward with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Pawlowski, and Representative Meyer asked that I thank the committee for bringing up this bill and apologizes that he could not be here today. Excuse me. The need for House Bill 116 was brought to the sponsor's attention by the Alaska chapter of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. House Bill 116 basically protects people that are helping law enforcement perform compliance checks on alcohol licensees from civil lawsuits and civil action. Under current statutes, a person can be sued by a licensee for four reasons. If a minor knowingly enters or remains on licensed premises, if a minor solicits others to purchase alcohol for them, if a person purchasing alcohol for a minor, or if they present false identification or misrepresent the age of a minor to the licensee. The problem is that our kids, cooperating or working with law enforcement, are knowingly violating these sections, and civil actions have been brought against youth that are volunteering with the police by licensees. The purpose of House Bill 116 is to ensure that these kids that are volunteering and helping keep what is probably the most dangerous and pervasive drug out of the hands of our young people aren't subject to civil lawsuits and the hassle of going through a civil action. That is, at the end of the day, the intent of the bill. And with that, I would answer questions from the committee.
Questions for Ms. Pawlowski. Senator Gass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, what's the difference between peace officer and law enforcement officer? Or maybe anyone on the committee?
Through the chair, Senator Guess, I am not certain. In ledge drafting, we had that discussion for a bit, and they said it was the more appropriate term for inclusion in the bill.
Okay. Actually, peace officers can be members of the Department of Fish and Game. Police officer has to have reached certain standards of the, what is it, Police Standards Council, etc. So there is a difference in definition, and maybe Senator French can find that. But police officer is more restrictive than peace officer. Senator French,
I don't find a law enforcement officer definition, unless I'm overlooking it or it's in some other section, but the general criminal law definition area, peace officer means a public servant vested by law with a duty to maintain public order or to make arrests, whether the duty extends to all offenses or is limited to a specific class of offenses or offenders.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Lasky.
I believe the intent on the more open definition is that the Alcohol and Beverage Control Board does not necessarily have police officers always enforcing the sections, and yet they are charged with alcohol enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Pulaski. Further questions? Senator Terrio.
Started a testimony by saying that his boss specifically instructed him to thank us, and I just want to know if that's true. Representative Myers said to start off specifically by thanking us, or did you just learn how to schmooze? It's always good to start with a schmooze.
For the record, Senator Terrio, it was actually the conversation we had in the hallway before I came back in.
Interesting, just to illustrate what we were talking about earlier on enforcement authority, even in the fish and game statutes under Title 16, 1605-150, it says the following persons are peace officers of the state and they shall enforce this title. So on it says an employee of the department authorized by the commissioner, a police officer in the state, or any other person authorized by the commissioner. So we are basically, by using peace officer, we're including police officer, but we're allowing other people to be designated under law. So, Senator French?
I just wanted to make sure we're all on the same version of the bill. I've got a couple in front of me, and then I've got backslash.
I've been looking at Yankee, and that is, I understand, the version that was passed on to us. So,
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't going to share the story, but Representative Meyer not being here was actually in a compliance check at the beginning of January of this year out in front of the A&P liquor store.
Who was that with us?
Representative Meyer.
He shared that with us.
There was, oh, he did?
I haven't heard the story.
Go ahead.
There was a 14-year-old with braces and a 19-year-old girl that said very clearly their age and asked Representative Meyer to purchase alcohol for them. This same team, within 8 minutes of starting their compliance check, had someone offer to buy them alcohol. To someone that says no, they give this little ticket, which is a thank you for upholding the state of Alaska's alcohol and beverage laws, and warns them that if they had indeed purchased for the minors, they could have been subject to a $10,000 fine. At the same time, those kids working could have been sued by the licensee.
Questions? Senator French?
I always have to ask, has any kid been sued?
Through the chair, Senator French, I believe there's one instance in Fairbanks right now that an 18-year-old is in the middle of a civil action around this, and Cindy Cashman from MAD might be able to testify that.
So, Mr. Pulaski, I hate to ask this question because we get this on other bills that come before us. So, by passing this bill, do we have anything in this bill, and I don't see it there, that has a retroactive cause that prohibits any action to be brought against a minor who has already participated in this process?
Mr. Chairman, we do not.
Is there a particular reason why not?
Mr. Chairman, talking to the sponsor, the concern was if there is one case that we know of, passing legislation retroactively to interfere with that particular case to the sponsor was problematic. As a policy statement going forward, he was all right with that, but just on a philosophical basis, going back and interfering with a single case was problematic to the sponsor.
Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, if the case is not if the case is still pending, and we change the law, and in fact we do impact the outcome of that case, I believe.
I would have a question on that, because I would think that any other minor who participated in this process, that there's a statute of limitations on the time that an action could be brought. So while we may have one case now, what's the term, Mr. Senator French? There are many others that could be inchoate.
Well, if you made it an immediate effective date, you'd shut it down pretty fast. I mean, you close the door right quick. And maybe Ms. Kesha could tell us about the pending case and we'll learn about
it. Okay. I just am concerned that when we do pass a law, because of its vital importance, that we don't leave someone who's been participating in a just cause dangling, even if there's only one. That's kind of where I stand on those kinds of things. Senator Guess?
Mr. Chair, Mike, what's the statute of limitations? Do you know? Or can you find out for us?
Through the chair, Senator Guess, I can find out. I do not know the statute of limitations in a civil action under this section.
Senator Terrio?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that as long as they haven't reached the final imposition of sentence, or, well, I guess it's a civil action? Oh, it's civil action. Oh, okay, that might change things.
We just went through one on pilots' pay, where we passed the law, we had no retroactivity clause to it, and we had to come back a year later, 2 years later, and say, well, geez, now there's been a case brought because of the 2-year statute of limitations on that particular issue, a class action case that was brought. And we had to say, whoops, we erred by leaving the bottom of the sack not totally sewed shut. And I'm just a little concerned that we might do the same thing here. And I don't care if it's only one, I guess, one person. That person is dangling out there with the possibility of a civil judgment being brought against them. We see that there's a need to change the law to keep that from being able to happen in the future. And I would be very prone to believe that we should sew the bottom of the sack shut so that other pending cases that are out there could not be brought, and this one, if it has not reached final judgment, could not be completed. So I hold the retailer that has done this in greatest disdain for having done something so egregious.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe it would be the sponsor's intent, and I would reiterate for the record that I believe that most retailers would not follow through with a civil action under this section against someone cooperating with a peace officer.
I agree. Any discussion, more discussion here among the members on this one particular point?
Well, just
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, just be consistent. You know, it gets to my point of nothing is beyond the imagination of some lawyers. That's a sad state for our country to be getting to.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we need to put this question to the drafter, and if at the very least have an immediate effective date, which would trigger a title change, but I'm certain there would be the votes in our side too. We would just make the title change, I believe. What was the passage out of the House?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, there were 3 very vocal opponents to the bill.
So that you'd have the votes over there, you believe, to change the title if, in fact, we put at the very minimum an immediate effective date?
We believe so. At the same time, there is... Do not underestimate the contempt with which a lot of the licensed community does hold the compliance check program. And I believe the sponsor would be very concerned about that issue coming up and what happens at the end of a session.
Senator Terrio.
We should at least check with the drafters to get the issue clarified in our own mind and then what decision we want to make moving forward.
I think we should look into this to see what potential liability there is out there, how we might consider tolling that liability, and then weigh whether or not we believe that the members on this side and the other side would object and decide where to go forward. After this bill leaves this committee, is it done? or does it go to finance?
Mr. Chairman, it is done. And we would commit to work the other body for purposes of finding out whether or not this issue would be palatable to the members.
I think that if there's no objection by the committee, I think that might be the course that we'll take here. We're not trying to mess with the sponsor's bill, but we've been in this court before, and we don't want to come back again.
Absolutely.
Is there, we do have, are there others that wanted to testify on the bill?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I hope that Doug Griffin from the ABC board was online to answer
questions. Is there to answer questions if we have them? Anyone else? Senator Theriault?
I wonder if Mr. Griffin can tell us where that particular case is, if he's got any information. And I am also curious what the establishment in Fairbanks was.
Mr. Griffin, are you online with us this morning?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Griffin, did you hear Senator Theriault's questions?
Yes, sir, I did.
If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your answers.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm pleased to appear in support of this bill on behalf of the sponsor and to appear before the committee. My name is Doug Griffin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, speaking to you today from Anchorage. Case that is still pending is in Fairbanks. I can't recall the establishment. I do know that the primary licensee is Mr. Lambert, who owns several businesses with liquor licenses in the Fairbanks area. I think Mike Pulaski is correct. This is not necessarily a popular program among segments of the alcoholic beverage community. I think the good licensees, so to a certain extent, embrace it. Those people that say operate on the margins do not. So you can bring your own, draw your own conclusions about a licensee that would contemplate taking civil action and using the civil action statute against someone who is working with law enforcement to try to ensure that sales of alcoholic beverages are not made to underage people. And the compliance check program, just to put in a brief plug, somewhat maybe a victim of its own success. When we started this program about 3 years ago, we found about nearly a 50% failure rate. And in the last round of doing it here this year, we're down under 10% failure rate. So it is getting the attention of the primarily package stores, but we also test restaurants and bars. So it's being successful for actually a fairly small amount of money, less than $100,000 a year. We've made great strides. So this protection is certainly well worth the efforts of the legislature to make this correction, and I certainly appreciate your interest in the retroactivity aspect of it that you just discussed.
Senator Theriault, having been quite involved in the pull tab wars of the legislature in the last couple of years, I recognize Mr. Lambert as a pull tab operator, and I believe also owns several liquor establishments where pull tabs are operated in Fairbanks area. So are there other questions for Mr. Griffin? Mr. Griffin, this is Senator Seekins, in your experience, how many young people would be in potential jeopardy if we did not have a retroactive clause here? Or could be in potential jeopardy?
Senator Seekins, that's a really difficult to answer because I do believe the statute of limitations, because it is a civil matter, is I think 2 years. I'm not, don't hold me to that, because certainly we deal mainly in criminal provisions. It's with this program that Representative Myers put forward to do the civil action, which has been effective in its own right, but unfortunately there's sort of this nexus here that where we have our people doing compliance checks being caught up in it. So I can't really say how many other cases may be out there. I think it is pretty rare that we have somebody that would come and do this. Obviously, it raises our eyebrows as a regulator of people in the industry that we have a licensee that would take civil action against someone who's actually trying to enforce the law or is working with the police to enforce the law. That sort of goes against the whole idea of being a responsible licensee and someone who sells this legalized drug of beverage alcohol.
Would you think, though, that the number of young people that participated is greater than 50?
It's much less than 50. You're talking about probably single digits, Senator Seekins.
Okay. You've only used a small handful of young people in this type of operation?
Mr. Chairman, I would ask Cindy Cashman to come up and perhaps answer.
Cindy, why don't you come on up? Ms. Cashman, if you'll introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Cindy Cashman, and as of February 28th, I was Executive Director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and we had a Youth in Action program, which continues to run under the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. That's where the majority of our youth are. They volunteer to work with the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. They're trained. In Juneau, well, what's happened is that because it's a relatively new program, we're still working the kinks out. Our idea of how to do a compliance check often differs from how, say, the ABC officer wants to do the compliance check, and so we work together to decide what works best for the community, and each community is different. I want to add that while the compliance check rate has gone up with the liquor stores, they've gotten smarter in that they have a phone tree, and if they recognize a compliance check going on, they'll pick up the phone and start calling each other, so that by the time you go around to any of the other stores that you're going to hit that night, they already know. They're waiting for us. So we've come up with other suggestions on how to deal with that, and we hope to do so in the future. As far as the number of youth, in Juneau alone, which only has a population of 30,000, in the past we've had very short notice on when that particular ABC officer is coming down to do the compliance checks. Within 48 hours, we can get between 5 and 6 youth who will drop what they're doing, rearrange their job schedule and their sports, whatever they're into, and do this. Go out on an all-night compliance check until, you know, the officer decides that they've done as many as they want to. So that's just Juneau alone. So I would disagree respectfully with Mr. Griffin in that it's the single digits. I would say it would be more in the range of about 20 to 25 youth. I'd also like to address about the pending case with the teenager in Fairbanks. This was a planned event. It was our understanding that some members of CHAR told the other members of CHAR, and I believe they even did it in writing, but I don't have that writing with me, that this is what they could do. They had found a loophole to take care of the stings, is what they call compliance checks, and they encouraged the rest of the CHAR members to take the kids to court. And we know of two of them, and one of them has actually done it, but we know of two of them in the Fairbanks area that intend to do this. Every time there is an underage drinking compliance check, they intend to grab the teenager and put him in court.
Thank you, Ms. Cashin. Questions for Ms. Cashin? Seeing none, thank you very much. I would suggest that what we do is we have an opportunity for staff to speak with the sponsor as well as members of the committee and to try to find whether or not what the potential is. We still are, we move fast when we move on this committee over here. but we would certainly like not to have to come back and visit this issue 2 years from now in order to protect someone who's unjustly challenged in court. So with that, we'll set this bill aside for the moment. And is there anything else that needs to come before the committee this morning? If you'll take a look at our schedule for tomorrow, we do have Public Health Disasters Emergencies, which is House Bill 95, House Bill 81, Contractor License Enforcement, which promises to be a hot topic, and Senate Bill 12, Limit Relations with Certain Nations, and then also bills previously heard or scheduled. So we will be meeting again tomorrow morning at 8:30. Are there any other questions, comments by the members? Seeing none, at 10:37, we are adjourned.